comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun. I say it's all right. It's all right. Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun. I say.
So, hey everybody, welcome to Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show. We're excited to have on the show today Jill Stein, who is building a national movement around her candidacy for the President of the United States in the Green Party, working with an old friend of ours, Ajamu Baraka, as the Vice President. And Jill, we're really happy to have you on Voices from the Frontlines.
It's really an honor to be with you here on the Frontlines.
And let me start by the question I'm not going to ask, which is, you are fully able to run for President of the United States, and if Hillary Clinton is worried, that's our problem, not yours.
I agree.
So can we move on past that one?
I think politicians do not have this new kind of entitlement called owning our votes. They have to win our votes.
So. I think you've done a great job with that, and I think winning people away from the Democratic Party, even those people like myself who are revolutionaries who at times have argued we should work for, let's say, Obama, mm-hmm. It's different from putting the onus on a third-party candidate asking, why are you running? I think it's pretty gross. So I just want to say we're thrilled you're running, and it seems like you're running a great campaign.
I think America is ready for a different kind of politics and is fighting angry and not happy with the candidates that we've got from this very corrupt political system. And Ajamu Baraka and I are the only candidates in the mix that aren't taking corporate money, lobbyist money, don't have a super PAC. So we're just here, you know, to lift up the voices of everyday people on the front lines of struggle who know that they need something different and that we are the ones we've been waiting for. They're not going to hand it to us on a silver platter. This is about that struggle for justice and democracy whose time has come. And this is the really wonderful and exciting thing that people are clamoring for what we're offering, you know, and which is essentially a politics of integrity that speaks to the emergency of the moment and the incredible life-changing opportunity of the moment to actually deliver on these crises. We can fix them.
Well, one of the things in the 60s when we addressed the Johnson versus Goldwater election and I was in the Congress of Racial Equality, and some people said part of the way with LBJ, because his slogan was all the way with LBJ.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us in the civil rights movement, we said no way with LBJ, right? But we did want Goldwater defeated. Mm-hmm. Shortly thereafter, as you know, Lyndon Johnson bombed North Vietnam,
right.
And
mm-hmm.
also destroyed the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party in Atlantic City. So we came into an anti-democratic party point mm-hmm. of view. We were radicalized in our struggle against the Democratic Party. How sharp are your criticisms of the Democratic Party? Do you see yourself anti-Democratic Party?
I'm definitely, outside of the Democratic Party. I don't know if I'm anti. I'm certainly not under the illusion that the Democratic Party is going to solve it for us because, you know, that that strategy of going halfway with LBJ, you know, is sort of this lesser evil kind of politics that's been practiced for a long time now. And it's not solving the problem. We really need an independent power base from which we can build. And, you know, the lesser evil has basically become a race to the bottom with the greater evil. And the whole thing just keeps marching to the right as the Democratic Party gets more corporatist, more militarist, and more imperialist. And we are really on the brink of catastrophe in so many ways, whether it's the new nuclear arms race, the new Cold War, which is hotter than ever with 2,000 nuclear warheads on hair trigger alert, and Hillary Clinton, you know, the alternative to crazy Donald. Hillary, unfortunately, wants to start an air war over Syria by declaring a no-fly zone, bringing us, you know, right smack dab into conflict with another nuclear armed power, Russia, with these 2,000 nukes on here, trigger alert, whether you look at the climate and, you know, the meltdown around us just in these last couple of weeks, you know, the environmental racism where as climate rolls out in southern Louisiana, where it's poor people getting hit for the second time who fled from Katrina, who are now having to move again to get out of the floodwaters, where aid comes last to those frontline communities of poor and black and brown people. You know, the fires up and down the West Coast here, the new records of heat, the catastrophe of ice melt that science is telling us now could be as close as 2050, where some of the studies are now saying we could see 9, 10, 11, 12 feet of sea level rise as soon as 2050, which will end it, you know. It's over if that's allowed to happen. So in my view, we're at this kind of Hail Mary moment now, you know, this existential moment where we decide whether we are going to have a world that works for all of us or it works for the 1%. And unfortunately, we got two political parties that are funded by the 1%, the war profiteers, the big banks, the predatory fossil fuel companies, the insurance companies. That's who's delivered on these politics. I don't think the Democratic Party is capable of solving this crisis. We need to put our feet down and build our power. In the words of Frederick Douglass, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, it never will. We saw how far revolutionary politics can get inside of the Democratic Party with the Bernie Sanders campaign. It was sabotaged by the Democratic Party. So I think it's time to let go of those illusions. It's not like it's easy going forward, but we, you know, we can't keep doing more of what is throwing us under the bus.
Well, let's deal with three specific issues. I want to go one at a time. The attacks on the black community, which I'll deal with last. Mm-hmm. As you said, imperialism, and I want to deal with Clinton's militarism, and then climate.
Great.
One of the things that was important in things that you're reading is I did not think Bernie Sanders, I think he his populism stayed inside the United States.
That's right.
It was very much about student loans and free this and free that. He wasn't trying to address U.S. imperialism.
Yes.
And it's pretty impressive that you are. Also, the nuclear issue, which I myself have sort of lost a little track of in terms of my consciousness, you've been pushing. So I want to take a minute on that.
Okay.
The anti-Sovietism, anti-Russia. Why don't you deal with what you think specifically is the nuclear threat in this campaign, which I think, by the way, you should even put more attention to, because I think it's a great line in the sand. But help me understand, what is your line in the sand with Hillary? What exactly is she saying, and what exactly are you saying?
Great. Hillary, it's hard to know what she's saying, you know, because she flips and she flops. And she's, in terms of imperialism and war and nuclear weapons, I haven't heard her say anything about nuclear disarmament, about the need to address this new nuclear arms race. Barack Obama, you know, has basically put a $1 trillion budget together for the next decade plus. $1 trillion on a new generation of nuclear weapons and modes of delivery, and that means missiles and airplanes and bombers, I should say, and submarines. You know, and they're also pushing we have surrounded Russia, you know, with nuclear weapons and missiles, and now they're pushing for troops and for NATO to move its forces in. We've quadrupled the budget for NATO to be in Eastern Europe. Very scary and aggressive stuff going on.
Right.
It's important for us to remember what it was like during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which we at the time thought was only missiles. We didn't know that there were also nuclear weapons, but still we went ballistic about it. And we essentially threatened, you know, nuclear war if those missiles were allowed to come near our borders. Now just imagine if there were also troops along the Canadian and Mexican borders as well as missiles all along them. We would not be sitting pretty. So it's very, I think, Eric, it's one of the best pieces of news I've heard recently is that the guy who sort of articulated this policy of U.S. world domination, that the world is a chessboard and that the United States should take over, right. You know, one square at a time. Zbigniew Brzezinski, right. Who was the, you know, the foreign policy advisor to
Carter.
To Carter, exactly, going way back. But then continuing, you know, he's a man who's still held in very high esteem, but now he's changed his tune. He said, you know, this doesn't work. We cannot dominate the world, and the world is moving ahead without us. We need to become not a dominator, but a collaborator. And it's time for us to start developing a collaborative relationship with both Russia and China based on diplomacy, not based on brute military force. Now, he's being ignored as he says this, of course, but Hillary Clinton represents that old score, that old point of view, this sense of domination with which she was all for the war in Iraq until quite recently, in fact, and she has sort of changed her tune on Iraq, but she led the charge into Libya in the catastrophic war that took place there. You know, these are outrageous wars that really violate the international law, which is that you cannot invade other countries unless you are imminently in danger from invasion or you've already been attacked. So, you know, this is very aggressive stuff. This is, you know, kind of Clinton for the long haul. You know, Clinton has been about power, about showing that she's more of a man than the guys out there, you know, sort of the Margaret Thatcher of foreign policy. And, you know, has proven herself to be extremely poor in her judgment and aggressive and has all the wrong reflexes that you do not want in power. So, and in terms of war, in terms of nuclear weapons, haven't heard that she's concerned in the least and that she does want to charge ahead with this no-fly zone over Syria. So this is all the wrong stuff. We're calling for a new foreign policy, turning over a new leaf and notifying our allies about this, that we no longer support a foreign policy based on economic and military domination, but rather on international law, human rights, and diplomacy. That should be the way forward. We should be the superpower of human rights, supporting truly grassroots economic development rather than corporate economic development and these corporate trade agreements. It was another piece of great news to hear this week that TTIP, the trade and investment deal for Europe, seems to be dead in the water and seems to be collapsing, which is a great thing because dominating the economies of other countries and allowing an international economic elite to financialize the world economy, to pit workers against each other, to put bankers at the head of our, you know, our global priorities. This is exactly wrong. They prioritize austerity as well.
Hold on there. Let me hold you there because I want to go back to the military. I wouldn't use superpower of human rights in terms of your advice. I'd find some other term that might be better. But a couple of things I want to – so I think one thing that's very important to draw the line is that the Clintons and, unfortunately, Obama are of the school of U.S. world domination.
Yes.
I think it's an important point you're raising, and both you and John will have talked about the atrocity and the invasion of Libya. I want to move to the black struggle.
Yes.
And I want to talk to you about some of our concerns about the Greens, because you know that the social base of the Greens is primarily right now white people, and you're trying to change that. But that is, at least in L.A., that's been a significant reality. Mm. And the Greens have not been a friend of the actual struggles on the ground in Los Angeles. I mean, mm-hmm. I'll give you some examples mm-hmm. that the Strategy Center has been involved in a fight to end the rail projects and to build a bus-centered system.
Mm-hmm. So
we know what we're talking about. We sued the MTA. We won in federal court to stop this rail, which is a complete gentrification mm-hmm. plan. It has no logic as a transit plan. Buses could be, we could be having 24/7 zero-emission buses, which is what we're mm-hmm. calling for. We're calling for free public transportation. Mm-hmm. We're also calling for an end to stop and frisk on the buses because, if you can imagine, 55% of the people getting tickets for fare evasion in Los Angeles are black. Mm-hmm. There should not be such mm-hmm. a crime as fare evasion, which simply means mm-hmm. you didn't pay the mm-hmm. fare. Mm-hmm. The Greens and the white liberals and the white progressives, the white everybody's, it's like we live in two societies, not simply segregated, but as you know, apartheid. And in every fight we've had here in LA, Jill, we have not gotten any white support for whether it's trying to get military weapons out of the schools. Mm-hmm. These kids are more concerned about Citizens United than black kids getting shot. So my question to you is, we've even had hostility from some Greens who are infatuated with the rail, even though they don't know what they're talking about. Even when we had a civil rights consent decree saying you can't build rail. So this is what you've inherited. I know you and John Moore are trying to not just change the social base, but the consciousness. But how do you deal with the fact that you're a candidate, and while you're taking on the Democrats, you have problems in your own movement to try to raise the consciousness of your existing base? How do, tell us about that.
Absolutely. And, you know, the Greens are very different from state to state.
Okay.
So in Georgia, for example, the leadership of the Greens is African American.
That's great. That's in why I said LA. I was careful.
Yeah. In Washington, D.C., it's actually called the Statehood Green Party.
That's
and,
great.
And the Statehood Party, you know, is largely African American. In my home state of Massachusetts, it's the Green Rainbow Party from the Rainbow Coalition before Jesse Jackson took it
is
back
Mel
inside.
Is Mel King still around?
Yes, he still is
around. Is he working with you?
Yes. I mean, he's been my mentor all along. He's not so into national politics for reasons I totally understand. But when we're on the ground together in Massachusetts.
Send my regards.
All right, great. I will do that. Yeah, he's been... he's totally been the guy who has shown me the way all the way. So it's very different. And part of the reason that I'm running with Ajamu Baraka is to bring the Green Party along on this because, you know, this is very much part of our mission to address the crisis of racial justice. You know, in my view, the Green Party needs to be a party of justice. You cannot achieve environmental justice unless you're also achieving racial justice and economic justice and labor justice and generational and LGBTQ justice and all that. In the words of Martin Luther King, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, and that's true across the silos of justice as well. So racial justice is the crisis right now of our era, and the fight to make Black Lives Matter is a fight about what kind of a society we're going to be where we are still living the legacy of slavery in this country that has never gone away. And from slavery to lynchings to Jim Crow to segregation, the war on drugs, police violence, mass incarceration, these are all part of a cultural struggle that has to be grappled with head on. And in the words of Martin Luther King, you know, we face really this triad of racism, militarism, and extreme materialism, aka corporate capitalism, whatever you want to call it. They're embedded with each other.
But the question I'm still asking is, what's the challenge with white people and the Greens? How explicit can you make, because you can quote King a lot, these white kids, I'm telling you, I work with them. They and this the Bernie Sanders kids too. They are not winnable on race very much. You have to smack some people upside the head.
Well,
a little
or
bit.
You or you overgrow them, you know,
yes.
because
okay,
you
good.
Totally overgrow them, and that's what's happening now.
All right, why don't
and,
you talk about that?
Yeah.
That's important.
So, when we're out there, for one thing, you know, yesterday I was at City Hall,
right, I heard.
Doing a live stream,
right.
enabling the people who are on the front lines of that occupation, enabling Lisa Simpson actually to talk about how she is struggling with the death of her son who was murdered by the police, and enabled her to tell her story before what's now hundreds of thousands of people who've seen that now on Facebook where we live streamed it, and also Professor Abdullah to share her vision.
Right.
And this is what our campaign is. It's predominantly frontline communities who we are here to serve because the front lines of struggle are the realities of American life for most people who are struggling to survive in one way or another. And by doing that, Black Lives Matter doesn't support or endorse candidates, but they were sure happy that we were there.
Absolutely.
And the week before, we were down in southern Louisiana talking to the victims of the flood, actually escorted by an African-American woman who wanted to take us to her community where help wasn't coming. Right. You know, it's not only African Americans who've been hit. It was a, you know, a multiracial storm, but the aid is not coming. Both, you know, FEMA, the presence of FEMA, and the nonprofits that could come around and like help people do laundry, you know, where everything is just covered in stinking filth. You know, they need access to those services. And we were there to live stream that, and that too got lifted up. We were also there to fundraise for them,
right,
and to put our platform at their service. And they, you know, the floodgates opened in their donations. We brought in a lot of Greens, actually, who came to help with the cleanup and solicited them. So, you know, we're here to do the right thing and to ensure that the Green Party is used on behalf of this crisis of racial justice. And there's been just an incredible response to it. And everywhere I go, we are bringing in lots of people, white and black and brown, who are overjoyed to hear an agenda that knits together justice across its many sectors, in which racial justice plays an absolutely key role. And we are finding enormous support for that. And I think this is kind of, you know, there's a lot of community leadership out there that has to be reflected in our broader political dialogue.
Right.
You got Donald Trump, who's reflecting the worst of what's out there, and that needs an antidote. And that antidote has to be lifting up the power and the glory, you know, of what a racially just society looks like and who we are. This, to my mind, is the beauty of running with Ajamu Baraka, because he doesn't mince words. When we did our town hall on CNN the other night, which was, it was supposed to be an hour, but they actually let us go for almost 90 minutes because there was so much interest in it. In fact, we were trending number one on Twitter for all those who say, oh, your campaign is so, you know, not of interest to the public. You're just 5% in the polls. Actually, 5%. Going on potentially 15, 25 and more,
right,
if only people had a chance to hear about it. So, you know, Donald Trump has gotten $4 billion worth of free media. Hillary Clinton's gotten $2 billion. We've gotten zip, but we're still rising up in the polls. And on CNN with Ajamu Baraka, it was like an hour and a half of what you cannot say on mainstream TV. It was breaking every taboo out there to tell the truth. And there was just a huge response to it.
Well, a couple of thoughts. As an organizer speaking to a candidate, one is I'd like you to look into our demand that President Obama and you end the federal DOD 1033 program, which gives
yes.
military weapons to local police, school police. I don't know if you know, the Strategy Center won the first ever effort to get a school board and a police department to give back the weapons to the Defense Department and to apologize to us. After we won, people said, you won. I said, no, we want an apology from the police chief. And we got one because he actually said, in looking at what happened at Ferguson, I didn't want to be that guy. And I realized the tank that I had asked for is now my responsibility to return.
Wow.
So then I went to a meeting of the Justice Department, of 50 civil rights groups and 50 police. Mm-hmm. And you should have seen those police. They came out armed verbally and saying, I want those weapons back. Mr. President, you don't represent us. We believe in states' rights. Give us those damn federal weapons. I want no restrictions. And Obama is considering lifting the very small restrictions he's placed on this weaponry. So I'd like you to look into it, because we have a national sign-on letter that's going
Great.
Out tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
Calling on the president to end the whole program whatsoever. And I think you
mm-hmm.
you could run with it, and we'd love you to.
Absolutely. All
Secondly,
right.
is there's a fight inside of Los Angeles to defeat a sales tax by the Los Angeles MTA called Proposition M. It's their fourth sales tax. It's going to mean that 10% of your income now is spent, 9% already in L.A. is spent
wow.
on sales taxes mm-hmm. to fund more rail,
mm-hmm.
more police to arrest people on rail.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you could take a stand on Prop M.
Mm-hmm.
And third, I think if you and Ajamu would call the question with white people in a thoughtful way. I'm not talking about, you know, we're talking about the role of moral transformation, to say that there is a white problem in the environmental movement. There is a problem of white chauvinism, and we want to change it. We believe you have the capacity to change, but you got to change. And I think you are changing. And I want to say on the positive, you're one of the few people we could talk to about this problem, but it still is a problem. And I think that the more you could figure out ways to identify it, that's how people move.
Great, great. No, I agree. And one of the things, you know, that we call for is this Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Yes, that's great.
So that we can actually tell the truth, you know, and tell the history and break it down, because living in the bubble of white privilege, people don't get what's going on, and they really need to hear it. In the same way, you know, that some of the recent shootings, you know, in Minnesota and in Baton Rouge, I think, Philando Castile and I forget the other one, you know, they were videos, you know, videoed horrific shootings, and it was like, it was a heart-stopping moment, heart-stopping, gut-wrenching moment. And that moment, you know, this is the moment that we're in, you know.
Right.
It's one outrageous death after the other. It's one video after the other.
That's right.
Recently in Tulsa, Oklahoma, you know, this latest thing, this 84-year-old grandmother who gets pepper sprayed in the face after the police have beaten down the door at 2:30 in the morning to chase some guy who ran a stop sign, basically.
Right. Exactly.
You know, a SWAT team type. Yeah, action for a traffic violation.
And with those 10.33 weapons, by the way.
I'm not surprised,
yes. We'll keep talking about that.
Right, and it's just one incredible, staggering story after the other. We need to sit down, because stories are powerful. And in these gut-wrenching moments, we need to have a formal, facilitated conversation at the community level all over the country. That's what this Truth and Reconciliation Commission is about, which we badly need after this election,
right,
in particular, which has really been fanning the flames of racism, fear, and hate. We need to sit down and rehumanize ourselves to each other. We need to be able to tell these stories, get real about the history, the legacy of slavery, which didn't go away just because of the Emancipation Proclamation. It just kind of transformed, and it's still there. We also call for reparations as part of this discussion, because it's been a cumulative, unending series of violent economic policies on top of violent physical policies.
Right.
But where you have an African-American family having 10 cents on the dollar to the wealth of a white family, That's not a livable society. And what happened in the Wall Street crash was that 10 cents on the dollar was reduced to 5 cents on the dollar. That didn't happen overnight. This has been the cumulative burden of racism that still exists today. It's not just in the economy and in jobs and in high unemployment rates. It's also, you know, the school system, where it's African American and Latino schools in particular that have been targeted by education reform, by high-stakes testing, by the school-to-prison pipeline. You know, we need to get rid of that high-stakes testing system. We need to reintegrate our housing and our schools and ensure that we have high-quality schools for every kid. Parents should not have to rely on choice, because if it's a choice for some, then the bad choice gets laid on others. We need high-quality public education based on teaching to the whole student for lifetime learning, bringing back arts, music, recreation, community engagement, the things that make school meaningful and enjoyable for students. It's not rocket science how to fix this. And there's all the resources in the world to do it when we stop dropping bombs on black and brown people around the world. I learned the other day that LA's budget, approximately half of the city of Los Angeles's budget, goes into this militarized policing, you know, and it's ironic because half the resources of this city are spent on an occupying force, basically, and half of our discretionary budget is spent on this outrageous, dangerous, bloated military budget.
Well, one thing I think would be helpful to emphasize, we've been saying that the Strategy Center focuses on demand development. We think that the demand is what people get clear about. I thought I agreed with you until you, that's what you meant. So I believe you talked about cutting the U.S. military budget by 50%. Is that your number?
That's right.
We're saying the only way to cut police brutality by 50% is to cut the police by 50% because the brutality is so endemic in the system.
Mm-hmm.
we're calling for a true 50% cut of police across the board budget, troops, and weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, as you pointed out, of the 50% cut, and
yeah,
I mean, $1 trillion now, moving to $1 trillion defense budget.
That's right.
I think the more you focus on those line-in-the-sand demands, because you have a unique opportunity right now. I mean, you have an 8-week window, and we know we're going to talk about it afterwards, but the reality is that this country is not deeply politicized between elections, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a chance for you and Ajamu to have a chance to call out certain questions that will be try to be pushed under the rug after the election, but we'll talk about that in a minute. But I just think the more you can stay on the Defense Department, you know, figure out what your 9 demands are and just keep hammering those, because I think, for instance, on the issue with Hillary, I think figuring out what, well, I'm going to ask you now, what would you demand that Hillary not do on back to nuclear weapons? What's your demand on nuclear weapons?
What we must do on nuclear weapons is end them. We need complete and total nuclear disarmament. And we need to sit down with the Russians, who've actually invited us to so long ago. I believe it was Putin himself who had called for reducing each of our arsenals to a total of 1,000.
Right.
And then bringing in all the other countries and essentially eliminating them. In fact, there's a movement right now in the United Nations to actually ban nuclear weapons because the nuclear-armed countries who supposedly had the responsibility for doing this are not doing this. You know, we just keep creating more countries and giving the thumbs up to more, including Israel and Pakistan and India that also now have nuclear weapons. So, you know, we need to reestablish nuclear disarmament as an essential survival issue and achieve that ASAP. This needs to be prioritized. We also call for canceling out the climate crisis with the right to a job, because the climate crisis is a crisis of environmental racism. Above all, it is black and brown people around the world, you know, who are most at risk in Bangladesh, in the, you know, in the islands that are about to disappear in the Pacific,
which I want to talk to you about,
and all the rest. It's poor people without infrastructure who are being hit by the consequences of our energy gluttony historically.
This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. That voice from the front lines you're hearing is that of Jill Stein, who's running for president of the United States on the Green Party ticket. And I would say to you that, say, well, how come you only get 2% or 3% or 4%? I'd say, well, don't worry about that. Make sure you vote for her. And that'll be one more vote than she had before you made that decision. So I'm not advocating it. I'm simply saying that might be an interesting choice you would make, maybe one that I would make. No, I'm going to make that. I'm not advocating what you're going to do. So this is Eric Mann. You're on Voices. Jill, what is your last word?
My last word is that this is a Hail Mary moment in so many ways. This election is not just about what kind of world we're going to have, but whether we're going to have a world or not going forward. The powers that be have a track record, whether it's Democrats or Republicans. It's been a race to the bottom. We are the ones we've been waiting for. We do have the power the minute we stand up. Just remember this. 43 million young people are locked into predatory student loan debt. Our campaign is the only way out. Get that word out. That's a big incentive. It's an irresistible incentive for 43 million people to come out and vote green. We don't have to split the vote. Don't settle for splitting the vote. We can flip the vote. Our future depends on it. Let's stand up. Together, we are an unstoppable force. Let's make it happen.
Eric Mann on Voices from Frontline. I want to thank Channing Martinez, our producer, who organized this, Melissa, who made it happen, Jill Stein, and Eric Mann. You can reach me at Eric at Voices from the Front Lines. And we're going to try to have Jill back for part two of this conversation before the election. But in any way, thanks for listening to Voices from the Front Lines. Jill, is there something, since I got to get my glasses on, tell me what.
Last thing, Jill2016.com or Dr. Jill Stein, DR, no period, Jill Stein social media. To join in, you can make a donation, you can volunteer, you can help get the word out. We have the power, let's use it. Oh, and we can get into the debates. So join our campaign to open the debates. In America, we not only have a right to vote, we have a right to know who we can vote for.
People want to hear this interview. How do people find it? Are we going to put it up on your Facebook or something?
Yes, we will have this on our Facebook, and we will have it on our website as well. So come and join us. And remember, in the words of Alice Walker, biggest way people give up power is by not knowing we have it to start with. We have it. It's time to use it. Join us.
Well, folks, as I always tell you, it's never old. All power to the people. Take good care of yourselves.
Much more than this, I did my way. If there were times, I'm sure you knew.